From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, Public Health Radio will be revisiting Canada. In March last year, Public Health Radio took an in-depth look at the Canadian healthcare system. The recent decision of the Supreme Court of Quebec calling for the introduction of private health insurance companies into Quebec's health system has sparked a renewed look at Canada's health system by many Americans and a good deal of controversy within Canada. But American media outlets have neglected to report on the process Canada has been undergoing for the last 5 years to reform and strengthen their healthcare system. So today, Pat and Hugh Armstrong, a husband and wife team of health policy analysts, are joining us to sort out recent events in Canada and revisit our neighbor to the north. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On July 14th, the Environmental Working Group released findings from a research project which looked for the presence of environmental toxins in the blood of 10 newborn babies. The babies' blood samples were collected by the Red Cross last September, and 287 toxic chemicals were found in the 10 babies. These babies averaged 200 pesticides, consumer product ingredients, and waste from burning coal, gasoline, and garbage. Of the 287 chemicals detected in the baby's blood, 180 are known to cause cancer in humans or animals, 217 are toxic to the brain and nervous system, and 208 cause birth defects or abnormal development in animals. The danger of pre- or postnatal exposure to this complex mixture of carcinogens, developmental toxins, and neurotoxins has never been studied before. Until recently, scientists believed that the placenta shielded cord blood and the developing baby from most chemicals and pollutants in the environment. The report is available through the website of the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, an independent panel of health experts, has recommended that all pregnant women be offered an HIV test to further reduce mother-to-child transmission of HIV. The recommendations state that the current strategy of only offering tests to pregnant women identified to be at high risk of HIV is missing opportunities to prevent mother-to-child transmission. Each year in the U.S., about 300 HIV-positive infants are born, and as many as a third of those are born to women who did not know their HIV status before pregnancy. The task force recommended that the test be voluntary for pregnant women. They noted that recent scientific advances have proven that testing all pregnant women is beneficial. Providing combination drug therapies, offering cesarean section delivery, and advising HIV women to avoid breastfeeding can reduce the risk of vertical transmission from about 25% to approximately 1%. Although the task force issued its strongest recommendation regarding prenatal HIV tests, it also recommended that children and adults with one or more risk factors for HIV transmission also be voluntarily tested. The risk factors include men who have had sex with men after 1975, anyone having unprotected sex with multiple partners, current or former injection drug users, people who exchange sex for money or drugs, individuals whose current or former partners are HIV positive, bisexual, or IV drug users, men and women who are being treated for sexually transmitted diseases, and anyone who has had a blood transfusion between 1978 and 1985. The task force did not recommend HIV testing for children and adults who have none of the risk factors. The report is available in the July 5th issue of the Annals of Internal Medicine. In another step that further blurs the separation between medicine and the pharmaceutical industry, the American Academy of Dermatology is expanding the number of dermatology residency positions by using drug company donations. Residency training is the critical final period of medical training in which newly graduated physicians care for large numbers of patients in supervised settings. The American Academy of Dermatology is attempting to build in safeguards that the drug industry money will not affect the educational process by combining the money into a general fund rather than assigning the donated money to an individual resident. Also, the pharmaceutical companies themselves were not involved in determining which residency programs will receive the donated funds. The rationale for accepting pharmaceutical industry money is the shortage of dermatologists nationwide. In many regions, patients are waiting over 3 months for a dermatology appointment. But Arthur Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, commented that the drug company funding created not only the appearance of a conflict of interest, but also the reality of a conflict of interest. And Jerome Kassir, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, strongly opposed this new step insinuating drug company money into the medical education process. The full article appears in the July 18th issue of American Medical News. Coming up next, healthcare in Canada. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. In March last year, Public Health Radio devoted an entire show to an exploration of healthcare in Canada. We discovered that, similar to all the other 25 developed nations of Europe, the Far East, and Australia, Canada provides health insurance to its entire population while spending far less than the United States. Canada devotes about 10% of its GDP to healthcare, while the U.S. spends over 15% of its gross domestic product on health. In Canada, as in most other developed countries, private health insurance companies are not involved in providing health insurance coverage for most medical services. Instead, the government provides health insurance for all the citizens of Canada. On the other hand, most all hospitals and doctors' offices are independent of the government. They are nearly all in the private sector. Canada leads the United States in every major category of health outcome, including infant mortality, maternal mortality, and life expectancy at every age it's measured for in both men and women. In fact, according to the United Nations Human Development Report, Canada now ranks 5th in life expectancy at birth, while the United States ranks 26th. Despite spending nearly double per capita on health care than the average of other developed nations, a large portion of the U.S. population has no form of health insurance. Over 1 in 6 individuals under the age of 65 has no health insurance, and at least an equal number are underinsured, meaning that a major medical illness would lead to great financial hardship. In Canada, all Canadians are insured through Canadian Medicare, with virtually all doctor and hospital care covered with no copays and no deductibles. But the Canadian health system has not been without problems. During the 1990s, the federal government of Canada cut back its funding support of the province's health departments, and this gradually led to cuts in capital funding and delays in the performance of elective surgery. In addition, despite the fact that the Canadian government negotiates far lower prescription drug prices than we pay in the U.S., the increasing cost of medicine has also caused financial difficulty for many Canadians. Starting at the end of the 1990s, Canada undertook a process to reevaluate its health system. The government convened a commission chaired by the widely respected Roy Romano to analyze the strengths and weaknesses of Canada's health system. The commission identified the problems we've been discussing, and Canada has gradually been addressing them. Especially important will be an infusion of an additional $41 billion to the system over the next 10 years. But despite its convenient location as our northern neighbor, the news media in the United States rarely looks at the Canadian healthcare system and has provided scant coverage to the efforts of the last 5 years to improve healthcare in Canada. On the other hand, all the major media outlets in the U.S. devoted prominent coverage to Canada on June 9th this year. On that day, the Supreme Court of Canada handed down a 4-3 decision finding for a Canadian man who suffered from advanced arthritis of his hip and was forced to wait an undue period of time for an operation to implant an artificial hip. The case had occurred in 1997 and had gone through several appeals over the years. The man contended that he should be permitted to purchase private health insurance because the public system was not providing adequate care. Joining us today to discuss the Canadian Supreme Court decision and other recent developments in Canada are a husband and wife team of health policy analysts. Pat Armstrong is an expert on health policy in Canada. She has served as chair of the Department of Sociology at York University and director of the School of Canadian Studies at Carleton University. Hugh Armstrong is a professor in the School of Social Work and in the Institute of Political Economy at Carleton University. The Armstrongs have co-authored several books on healthcare in Canada, which are detailed at the Public Health Radio website, publichealthradio.org. A particularly useful book for those of us in the U.S. is a book they authored called Universal Healthcare: What the United States Can Learn from the Canadian Experience. The book is available through the New Press in New York City. Pat and Hugh Armstrong, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Good to be here.
Thank you for inviting us.
It's a fairly rare event in the United States for any topic related to any other country's healthcare system to make it into the media. But there was an exception to that that occurred, I believe it was June 9th, when the Supreme Court released the Shawi decision. So for listeners who have not been following the issue, I'm wondering if you would describe the issues that the court faced and the decision that the justices rendered.
Well, it was a Supreme Court of Canada decision, a very narrowly determined one, 4-3 decision, with two of the Supreme Court seats being vacant at the time. And basically, it struck down a law in the province of Quebec, which had prohibited the sale and purchase of private health insurance for those items that are provided through the Quebec government-funded system. So it was a decision that was based on the determination by the Supreme Court overturning two lower court decisions that the wait time for the particular individual who sought hip replacement surgery was unreasonably long. The wait time was in 1997. Subsequently, of course, the governments have been working hard to lower waiting times for a whole range of things, including joint replacement surgery.
Now, in the U.S. media, the court's decision in Canada was presented as clear evidence that the Canadian system is failing and is in very deep trouble, and that Canadians just can't get good health care due to deficiencies and shortages in their system. And I would say that the right wing in the United States has taken it even a step further, in alleging that this is always how it is with government healthcare systems. And I'd like your response to those ideas.
Last week, Hugh and I had the opportunity to spend some time with the man who headed a Royal Commission investigation into the future of healthcare in Canada. And he was talking about this decision.
You're talking about Roy Romano?
Yes.
And he was talking about how the decision completely ignored the evidence. The evidence that, in fact, our system does provide care to people in reasonable time and in an accessible manner. There was just a poll done of people who'd used hospital care, and 90% said their care was good or very good in hospital services. So he was quite definite, Roy Romano, that this decision could only been made out of ignorance.
The criteria that seem to us most relevant when considering healthcare is our first number one, cost, number two, quality, and number three, access, in no particular order. And one might add a fourth criterion around democratic control. I think the evidence, which the Supreme Court majority ignored, is that if you establish a second private tier for things that are covered through a single-payer public system, costs go way up. And, of course, the chief source of evidence on that is a comparison between Canada and the United States. Secondly, quality does not go up. In fact, there's some evidence that quality goes down with two tiers. And, of course, thirdly, access is diminished with a second private tier. Access for some people, of course, increases because they have thick wallets and can afford to jump the queue. But access overall, in fact, deteriorates. The evidence shows in Canada, where we have a few examples of a parallel private sector, for instance, in cataract eye surgery, and in the United Kingdom and in other countries where there are two tiers. So as Roy Romano, I think, argued, I know he argued very forcefully a week ago, the Supreme Court majority saying two-tier would help solve the problem is to ignore the accumulated evidence that it will not solve the problem in terms of access. It will redistribute wait times. It won't reduce them. It will not solve the problem in terms of quality. It will not solve the problem in terms of cost, and will be, in our terms at least, undemocratic, because it will remove from democratic discourse and decision-making the prospects for improving the system.
I think it's really important to reiterate, too, that two other courts rejected by significant majorities this kind of action and said that it was not, that they hadn't established the case. And then we get a narrow decision at the Supreme Court level that says that they established the case for this one person on getting a new hip, basically. And there's even a dispute about how long this person waited for this surgery. And in Canada, of course, everyone would eventually get it. That's the other important point, that there's no question that if you needed hip surgery, that you're eligible to get it, and you would get it without cost. The question is, how long do you wait? And part of the issue is, when do you start counting the wait? This isn't someone who had an accident to their hip and needed a new hip. This is someone who had a deteriorating hip, and the wait time was calculated from the time he decided that he would like a new one till when he got it. And there's even dispute about how long that was.
Now, Hugh, you just presented your thoughts, and perhaps the thoughts of Roy Romano, that creating a private insurance market and a two-tier health system won't help with any of the problems in the Canadian system. But when I think about private education in the United States versus the public school system, I would think that there'd be reason to think that it wouldn't be not merely be unhelpful, but it might actively be harmful. Here in the U.S., many parents feel that their public school systems in their communities are failing their children, and they may pull their children out of public school. And when they do that, they put their children into private school much of the time, or pay the price of educating the children themselves. And that's, both of those are very expensive. Private schools are very expensive in the United States. And then when it comes up to the annual vote for the school budget, these are not people who are going to want to pay a lot more money in taxes to make the public school better when they've already opted out of it. So I'm wondering if there's concern that that reasoning may apply to Canada if they start allowing private insurance systems.
Certainly. We also have some private schools, although I don't think we have as many as is the case in the United States. But the same logic applies. Those who pay extra money for what they consider to be better or faster education or healthcare or whatever are reluctant then to pay taxes to support the majority who don't have that system. So they then jeopardize the public system by prompting a kind of tax revolt, and the people who can pay for private education or health care are, of course, almost by definition, the richer people in society, and therefore politically often the more powerful. So yes, it is of necessity a threat to a public system. And if we end up with a system that is just for the poor, we can be assured that it will be a poor system. It's much better to keep the wealthiest and most powerful of our citizens in a single universal system, such as currently holds for physician and hospital healthcare services in Canada. It's much better to hold them into in the public system, because then they will demand that it be a good system.
And also, there is a finite number of physicians in Canada. So if they start going into a private system, then they're not available to the public system. So all you're doing is redistributing who gets care. If we need more physicians, and that's something that's debatable about how fast you should get service, which is the issue here, if we need more physicians, it makes more sense for the public system to get more physicians than to take some of the physicians out of the public system and make them available for private care, which is what this would do.
To add to what Pat just said, there are now some proposals in Canada to set up kind of Cadillac primary care systems, so that the primary care physicians would spend as much time with you as frequently as you wanted if you paid some extra money. These will probably be deemed illegal by the various provincial governments, but at least there's some talk of these systems being established. The trouble with them, given a finite number of doctors, is that if they spend more time per patient, per rich patient, then there will be even fewer doctors available for the rest of us. And so the system will deteriorate. So it's not just a matter of the political forces at work in terms of a shift of resources. It's also a matter of the human resources at work among the physicians and indeed nurses and technologists and everybody else who provides healthcare.
Because I live in Vermont, not terribly far from the Canadian border, the Canadian broadcasting system is actually included in our cable TV here. So, and I try to watch it. I can't do it every day, but after that Supreme Court decision, I have to say that what most impressed me about the CBC's coverage of the court decision is how little coverage there's been. It seemed to me that by the third day after the release of the court decision, they were back to covering bad weather out in Alberta and, you know, Paul Martin's maneuverings as usual. And is it your impression that Canadians, or at least the media in Canada, are taking this court decision in stride or are not terribly concerned about it?
Well, I think that it's clear it only applies to Quebec at the present time. So there would have to be cases in other provinces brought for it to apply somewhere else. And it was also, as Hugh said at the beginning, about a case that happened 7 years ago now. And all of the provinces could produce evidence that they have allocated resources to addressing the wait time. So it's not clear that the decision is relevant today. And I think it's very important point, because in a public system, what you can decide is, okay, we have wait times if for hip replacements. Now, we have wait times now because we, as you well know, weren't doing them 20 years ago, right? And many, many more people are getting them, and they get them fully paid for under the public health care system, so the demand has increased enormously. But we have put in a whole lot more resources to address precisely these kinds of waitlist times, and we've been reducing them dramatically. And it's something you can do through a public system, just as we have done in the case of cardiac care, by organizing a provincial system to address wait times in this province of Ontario. We have been able to dramatically reduce the amount of time people wait for cardiac care by marshaling our resources together and addressing the problem. And we've been doing it in these other areas. So I don't think that there, I think that's part of the reason there isn't a big panic in response to this decision.
I suppose another reason is competing news demands. And we do have a minority federal government, and it was on the brink of being defeated, forcing us into a summer election. So that was a pretty dramatic news story that has now ended, but certainly was very alive earlier this month.
Now, while the media in the United States paid a lot of attention to the recent Canadian Supreme Court decision, I believe that all of the major news outlets in the United States completely ignored two other events which have taken place since the last time that we spoke, which was about 16 months ago. And I'd like to ask you about both of those. The first of them was that the Canadian Broadcasting System undertook a large survey late last year which asked which figure in the history of Canada they most admired. And actually, I was personally astonished at the result. I just assumed they would select a famous military leader or some prime minister who had guided Canada through a difficult period in her history. But the result was neither a prime minister nor a military hero. Instead, Canadians selected Tommy Douglas as the person they most admired in their entire history. For listeners who may not be familiar with who Tommy Douglas was, could you tell us about what Tommy Douglas did?
Besides the grandfather of Kiefer Sutherland?
Yeah, his daughter, Shirley Douglas, married Donald Sutherland, and while they were married, one of their offspring was Kiefer Sutherland. But that may be why he would be best known in the United States, but in Canada he is best known because as the premier of Saskatchewan, a prairie province of small size, about 1 million population, he introduced the first hospital and then physician universal accessible comprehensive healthcare system, which was eventually free at the point of service. That was so successful in Saskatchewan, despite the controversy that surrounded its introduction.
And in spite of them being heavily in debt as a province.
Despite those things, they made it happen in Saskatchewan. It was enormously popular. And a few years later, the federal government, a Liberal government, and so a centrist government, not a somewhat left-wing government like Tommy Douglas's, introduced a federal system that would provide federal dollars to provinces that essentially would copy the Saskatchewan example. And by 1971, every province had decided that it would join, and hence we have what we call Medicare. So Tommy Douglas is widely regarded as the single most important figure in introducing what is Canada's best-loved social program. And indeed, for many Canadians, it is a key element of our national identity, that we are a society that is a caring society, a sharing society that provides health care to all, whatever their economic condition.
And I think it's important to point out that this wasn't just a survey of subscribers, that the Canadian Broadcasting System ran a whole series on Canadians of note who initially were nominated by people on a website. And they selected 10 of these people who were the most popular. And they then ran half-hour programs on each of these people and what they'd contributed to Canada. So it wasn't just a random survey, but it was a survey based on a knowledge that people had of the kinds of contributions people made. And it's just another indication of how this is Canada's best-loved social program. And for many people, it's what identifies us as a country compared to your country.
So there were other people, like politicians, as you point out, Pierre Trudeau, one of our prime ministers, for instance, scored fairly high. Did Wayne Gretzky, our most notable hockey player, and Frederick Banting, the discoverer of insulin. There were other people who were in the top 10, but Tommy Douglas emerged very clearly as number one.
And you were not surprised at that selection?
No.
Not particularly, no. It was a hugely popular event, attracting millions of votes.
And lots of school children viewed this as, you know, it became part of school curriculums in many places and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it was pretty, I think it was representative of a very strong sentiment in Canada about what is important.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today are Pat and Hugh Armstrong, experts on healthcare in Canada. And we've been discussing recent developments affecting the Canadian healthcare system. After the break, we'll discuss the effort of Canada to expand its healthcare system to include coverage for prescription drugs, and we'll also be looking at other recent developments there. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On today's show, our guests are Pat and Hugh Armstrong, two Canadian health policy analysts who are experts on the Canadian healthcare system. On the first part of the show, we discussed the recent Supreme Court decision in the province of Quebec, which ruled in favor of permitting private insurers to establish themselves in that province. And we looked at the results of a recent poll which selected Tommy Douglas, the founder of the Canadian healthcare model, as the most admired person in the history of Canada. For the second part of the show, we'll be discussing last year's conference of the premiers of all of Canada's provinces and what they recommended for the future of Canadian healthcare, and then what types of agreements were reached with the federal government and what that's likely to mean for the future of healthcare in Canada. Now back to the interview. The final event I'd like to turn to occurred on July 31st last year. And there was a meeting of the premiers of all of the Canadian provinces. And on the final day, there was a press conference in which the premiers, all of them, were unanimously suggesting that Canadian Medicare should expand to include coverage of prescription drugs. And they were also saying that they felt that the federal government should fund it. I guess I'd like to start out with a point of information perhaps for listeners to the show, most of whom are in the U.S. Many Americans may be under the impression that the Canadian healthcare system covers prescription drugs, partly because almost everyone in the U.S. knows that Canadians pay much lower prices for medications. But that's not actually true. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's not true that we cover everybody, unfortunately. I think we should, but we don't. At the moment, if you're in hospital, your prescription drugs are covered freely for you as an individual. And beyond hospital, our system is for prescription drugs is much like the U.S. system for healthcare in general. That is to say, we cover the poor, we cover the elderly, we cover the military, we cover the severely disabled, and then varying from province to province, we cover other people for the cost of prescription drugs.
It's important to note that three provinces, Quebec, Saskatchewan, and British Columbia, already have pharmacare programs in place.
Yeah, so some have gone a good deal farther than others have. And the proposal from the premiers was to have the federal government pay a good deal more money to cover all the prescription drug costs. That did not go over well with the federal government, in part because they thought there were other problems that were also worthy of attention, notably waiting times. And so in September of last year, a month and a half or so after the premier's meeting in July, the premiers and the federal government agreed on a 10-year plan for improving health care and for putting more federal money into health care. And it's now being rolled out. It meant an extra $41 billion over the 10 years from the federal government to the provinces and territories to cover what's here called catastrophic prescription drug coverage, which means if your costs are really high because you've got a chronic disease of some kind, then there will be a provincial plan with federal subsidies. But it also covered a number of other things, including more money spent on diagnostic testing and more on wait times and a couple of other items.
I think it's important to note that it's still very much on the agenda. It hasn't been removed from the agenda. PharmaCare is still part of what they have identified as priority areas for the future in terms of development. And when we introduced universal programs for hospitals and doctors, much more of care was provided in hospitals and by doctors in ways that ensured that drugs were covered. Now so many more drugs are taken outside of that system that it's become a bigger issue, and it's one of the reasons why there's talk of extending it to drugs. And of course, the other question is the extent to which the prices have been rising in Canada. They haven't been rising as much as they have been in the United States. But those provinces like British Columbia, for instance, where they have a provincial pharmacare program and what they call reference-based pricing, and which basically means that in a whole lot of categories, the government agrees to pay the price of the acceptable generics that will address the issue. And that has helped lower the drug prices for all of the drugs.
We could add that although we are very concerned about the price of prescription drugs in Canada, and in fact we spend more of our health dollar on prescription drugs than we do on physicians, and we have for a number of years done so, you, I'm sure, and your listeners know that drug prices in Canada, prescription drug prices in Canada, are a great deal lower in most cases than they are in the United States. And this is because there is a federal regulation capping the price of new patented prescription drugs. Basically, it says the manufacturer can charge only the average of the price that is charged in seven industrial countries that include the United States, but also include several European countries. So that has been what has kept our prices, by and large, a good deal lower than your prices, and that in turn has prompted seniors to get on buses and come to Canada, and in some cases to try and order drugs over the internet from Canadian pharmacies.
The prices are also kept lower by the government being a major purchaser of drugs, and they can negotiate better prices.
Which I gather has been outlawed by the U.S. Congress in your case.
That is the case. You raised some of the issues in discussing that conference of last summer that I heard addressed on the Canadian broadcasting system. But I have to say that one of the striking things viewing that headline from the U.S. was that you had unhesitating unanimity among all the premiers all across Canada, even the most conservative among them. We always hear about Ralph Klein of Alberta, who's always promoting privatization of health services, and I assume he's considered very ultra-conservative. But there he was, going along with the rest of them, asking for what I would assume is the largest expansion of the Canadian Medicare program, probably in some decades, I assume.
Well, of course, it's relatively easy, despite his ideological position, for him to say, yes, we should have more money from the federal government. I mean, there's the politics of that. But
they were definitely saying that on the CBC. Yeah.
Well, but there's another factor, which is that Ralph Klein can read the public opinion polls as well as can any other politician, and he knows that the citizens of Alberta, as well as the citizens of other provinces and territories, favor our public system. This is remains, despite our concerns about the deterioration of our system, some warranted concerns, some not. Despite that, most Canadians want to retain our public single-payer system.
Well, and if we go back to the Supreme Court decision, the recent Supreme Court decision, it's important to note that the premiers came out and denounced the decision and said that that wasn't going to be the way they were going to go in their provinces. And that was true whatever the government, whether it was a Liberal government or a Conservative government, that they know where the public stands in terms of this as a major direction. People don't want it. And neither does big business. You know, compare it to the troubles your auto manufacturers, for instance, are going through in terms of paying health care coverage for retirees. It's not the same issue in Canada because there's a public system. And so even Conservative governments recognize that a universal health care system has helped business. And so, and that's particularly the case in the, obviously the case in the auto industry, but it's true for all large corporations and even, and small ones as well, that they don't have to worry about paying big health care expenses because it's covered under general taxation.
Are there many large corporations in Canada that are actually advocating for a U.S.-style system?
Not that I've heard. And in fact, the largest auto manufacturers came out with a joint statement from the unions supporting a public health care system very recently. They certainly said that to the Royal Commission on the Future of Healthcare, and they've said it more recently as well, because they know that it is makes more sense for big business to have the cost shared amongst all Canadians.
Looking at this, the issue of the premiers supporting the expansion of Canadians' single-payer health system, including Ralph Klein and the other people in the Conservative Party, it was still very striking from an American point of view. And again, I'm going to talk a little bit about my observations of from watching the CBC. It strikes me that on many, many issues, the Conservative Party in Canada seems to be saying many of the same things that the Conservatives and the Republican parties say in the United States about expanding the military, supporting the, for example, the war in Iraq. On many issues, they seem to be close. But here you are on healthcare, that wasn't happening. And what was very striking, watching this from the U.S., was that at the very same time that the premiers were weighing in on how to expand the Canadian system to include prescription drugs, in the U.S., the elderly people in the United States who had been pushing for years to include prescription drug coverage in the American Medicare program, they finally had gotten it right around that same time. And instead of including it in the public system, the crafters of this prescription drug program in the U.S. turned somersaults to try to introduce private insurance companies and HMOs and pharmacy benefit managing corporations and all these for-profit and other corporations into the Medicare system, just really, oh, in many cases, openly admitting that their motive for doing so was that they believed in privatization. And yet, here you are in Canada with the precise opposite statements coming from what I assume are the most conservative elements in Canada.
Well, it has a lot to do with the success of our system, in spite of, first of all of the kind of stories you hear in the United States about our system. Our system, for the most part, works quite well. And secondly, in spite of a campaign within Canada by many forces to try and undermine the confidence in the system, those people who use it still think it really works. you know, I mean, it is still the case that Canadians go to use can use any hospital or any doctor, and they don't pay any fees, and they can use them for as long as it's medically necessary or as often as it's medically necessary without paying any user fees. And the more Canadians watch American television, not the news, but medical shows, the more they become aware that this doesn't happen in Canada, that you don't get asked for money in order to get care. All you do is produce your provincial health care card. And Canadians know that. And, of course, they sometimes travel in the United States and become even more aware. When Hugh and I speak at places about the Canadian health care system in Canada, we often have people come up to us to tell us how shocked they were to go to the United States and see the signs that are in emergency rooms, or, you know, that they've had an experience encountering the system in your country, and it makes them aware of how the system in Canada is accessible and is much less burdensome on them than the media would have them believe in either country. So, and that public support translates into what politicians hear on a daily basis.
And so if they go to ski in your state, a wonderful skiing experience, they buy extra health insurance because there's widespread knowledge passed by word of mouth that you have to have it if, perchance, you have a serious fall while on snow.
Now, you've said earlier that the Canadian government is agreeing to increase its funding by $41 billion over the next, I guess, 10 years.
That's right.
But the for
and
that
this
to
is
be...
for a population smaller than California, remember.
Right, but for that to be an appropriate measure, which I assume it is, it implies that the system has been underfunded and for some period of time, and that's what's led to the waits that Mr. Zeliotis faced when he was getting his wanting to get his hip replaced in 1997. And it's also common knowledge that Britain's health system is underfunded, and in France and Japan, doctors are paid incredibly poorly. And I guess I want to ask you, here in Vermont, we're grappling with how we ought to reform our healthcare system. And because ours is getting expensive and we're having increasing numbers of people without insurance. And the people who argue against government systems have the belief that they inevitably become underfunded. And you can certainly give the examples of Britain and Italy and the other ones we just discussed today. Is that your belief that government systems tend to become underfunded over time?
No. My initial response is that there is no correct, technically correct answer as to what the appropriate funding ought to be. That it is, except in the United States, largely a matter of political debate. I suppose Switzerland would be the other place where it isn't so much a matter of political debate. In your country, and to a lesser extent in Switzerland, the costs are out of control. But they're out of control because, in part, there isn't a political debate about how much should we spend on this as against how much should we spend on roads or schools, or how much should we leave to individuals to spend on things of their own choosing. There will always be, in the country that largely determines the amount of appropriate spending politically, there will also always be people who say you're not spending enough, and there will always be people who say you're spending too much. But it's a democratic political debate that we have, and what the politicians have learned is that whenever they face the electorate says, first and foremost, give us better health care. And the politicians, as you say, of every political stripe, came together most recently last September to agree that more would be spent, and indeed that it would be spent on some specific things, like more coverage of prescription drugs taken outside hospital, and efforts to reduce waiting times, and efforts to increase the number and availability of diagnostic equipment, and efforts to improve home care, the care that people get in their homes when they leave hospital more quickly than was the case in the past.
I think that it's that also, in addition to the point about you know, how do you determine underfunding? I think that it's important to say that government systems can provide reasonable care, reasonable access to care. We know that that's true. We've done it in Canada. It's true that the healthcare budgets were dramatically slashed, and there were three arguments for those slashing of budgets. One was we should follow the American model to privatization in terms of private management. Another was that we should bow to pressure from international organizations like the World Bank and the IMF, saying that you can't have a deficit. And the third was arguments about how you shouldn't be investing in healthcare anyway. You should be investing in preventing illness in the first place. I think that we've reached a new equilibrium now in Canada in terms of spending that says that following many of those practices taken from the private sector in healthcare was a mistake, that we don't have a deficit right now in Canada, and therefore that argument no longer holds water, so we've been able to invest heavily in healthcare, and that while we are putting a big emphasis on preventative healthcare, that the crisis around SARS did make people aware that we have to maintain make sure that we invest in the public health system as well. So I don't think that there's an inevitable underfunding, even given the sort of, you know, you can never put enough money in healthcare, and you always have some form of rationing. I think that governments can say that that rationing is based on two things: universal access on the basis of need versus ability to pay, and secondly, on some democratic decision-making about the extent to which you fund it and the extent to which you cover certain kinds of things.
Let me add one further thing that Bob Evans, a health economist from British Columbia, always insists on, and that is that for every dollar of expenditure, there is, by definition, a dollar of revenue. And so that the people who are getting the money, whatever the level, are particularly interested in getting more money. So this applies to organized medicine, it applies to hospital administrators, it applies to drug manufacturers, whomever. So there will always be voices saying, we're not spending enough. But we should have at least a modicum of skepticism about the source of those voices.
Would you identify any other events of note over the last year or so affecting healthcare in Canada?
There has been, as Pat suggested just a minute ago, the establishment of a new public health agency in Canada, and it's not at all clear what it will do, but it is an attempt to supplement the emphasis we have on healthcare as, if you want, illness care, with a renewed emphasis on prevention and promotion. It's now a federal department. It has its own minister, member of cabinet, and as I say, it's just rolling out at the moment, but it, I think, holds some promise. It is in part prompted by the experience with SARS and prompted by the prospect of a coming pandemic, flu pandemic. It's also prompted by the claims, I think arguments appropriately made for years, that that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. But, of course, we have to, at the same time, argue that we need to spend the money on the cure when it's called for.
I suppose another thing that's noteworthy, and in this, to some extent, we share with what's been going on in your country as well, concern over a shortage of doctors and nurses in particular in both countries that is receiving a lot of attention in Canada. And so, for instance, we've just established a new large medical school that will be focused on rural, training people to work in rural and remote areas of the country. As you know, Canada is huge, and when you say that you're going to provide a universal health care plan, that means that you are providing that universal coverage for communities in the high Arctic that have very few people in them, you know, over huge spaces. And there has always been a problem of servicing those communities just because because they're rural and remote, and there has been a specific program developed in Canada, and again, made possible by the fact that we have a public system, to develop a medical school that will train this fall. It will take in 56 new students who will spend their training period primarily in communities in rural and remote areas. This kind of initiative, I think, is quite exciting. 56 doesn't sound very many, but we get 56 for the next 10 years. We'll go a long way towards ensuring that we have doctors in those communities.
And similar initiatives for nurses and for other health professionals.
And nurse practitioners and midwives. We now, and the other expansion that's happened in Canada over the last decade is the public funding of midwifery programs across the, not every province has it yet, but we're certainly moving in that direction as well. So, and there's a renewed emphasis on primary care, emphasizing group practices or community health centers.
Pat Armstrong and Hugh Armstrong, I'd like to thank you both so much for rejoining us on Public Health Radio.
Yes, it's been very good to talk with you again and through you to your listeners.
Well, thank you for inviting us, and we're happy to talk about the Canadian healthcare system anytime. We can learn from each other, I think.
A useful website for listeners seeking more information on the Canadian healthcare system is the website of the Canadian Health Coalition. Their web address is healthcoalition.ca. At the Health Coalition's website are links to the Romano Report, the key document that analyzed and gave direction to the reforms in the Canadian healthcare system, which we've been discussing today. Also, the Canadian Supreme Court decision and some critical analyses of it are available at the Health Coalition's website. Once again, that's healthcoalition.ca. Another useful resource is the website of the Canadian Health Services Research Foundation, chsrf.ca. Their website contains a great deal of data on healthcare in Canada, much of which refutes many myths held by Americans about the state of healthcare in Canada. That's chsrf.ca. And links to those websites will be available at the Public Health Radio website. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.